Greetings, fellow voyagers on Starship Earth. This is Cory Doctorow, and this is the Cory Doctorow podcast, where once again, we debate whether or not this lost generation ship does indeed have a control room, and whether we can find it and seize the controls before our species plummets into the sun. Not really, but boy, it feels that way, doesn't it? I have some new talks coming up that I hope you might come and hear on the 17th of June at 8:30 a.m. Pacific, which is 5:30 p.m. in Berlin. I am giving the keynote at the Transparency by Design conference. You can find information about that by typing Transparency by Design Doctorow into your favorite search engine. I strongly recommend Ask Jeeves or AltaVista. Alternatively, you can go to pluralistic.net and just scroll down to the bottom of the latest entry, which always has my upcoming talks. You can also catch me on July the 10th with Hank Green. Hank Green is a vlogger and famous YouTuber and brother of John Green, who wrote The Fault in Our Stars, among many other things. Hank wrote a superb book in 2018 called A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor that I reviewed and blurbed and actually went to a publicity event for in Houston and interviewed Hank for. And the sequel is coming out. It's called An Absolutely Remarkable Thing. It comes out on July the 7th, which is the same day that Tor Books is re-releasing Homeland and Little Brother as a single omnibus edition with a new introduction by Edward Snowden. So we are cross-promoting one another's books, and I will be interviewing Hank on a live stream for Minneapolis's Magers and Quinn bookstore. Again, you can find that information just by scrolling to the bottom of the latest pluralistic.net entry. And Hank and I are going to talk about our books. Mostly I'm going to interview Hank about his book, and you can buy one or both of our books at that event from Magers and Quinn and help support a great independent bookstore in a city that is struggling. So those are my upcoming talks, and of course I have some upcoming publications. As I mentioned, there's this new edition of Little Brother and Homeland coming out on July the 7th. On July the 14th, my very first picture book is coming out, Posey the Monster Slayer. Again, scroll to the bottom of any recent entry in Pluralistic, and you will find instructions for pre-ordering a copy if you'd like. You can get it from our local horror and science fiction bookstore, Dark Delicacies, and both my daughter Posey, who is the namesake of the protagonist, and I will sign and personalize your copy, and they will ship it to you in time for the release date on July the 14th. And obviously, on October the 12th, the third Little Brother book is coming out. It's called Attack Surface. You can pre-order it now, and on the publication date, if you pre-order it now, you will get a free Marcus Yalow Little Brother short story called Force Multiplier, which will come both as an ebook and as an audiobook. Now, that's a lot of writing projects in the can, but I have a lot of writing projects underway too, and I thought I would briefly go over them since it's been a while since I talked through what I'm working on these days. At the moment, I am working on my next novel, a post-Green New Deal modern monetary theory utopian novel about truth and reconciliation with white nationalist militias called The Lost Cause. The Lost Cause just broke 25,000 words, so it's getting up there and doing well. In addition, I am working on a little short story for MIT Tech Review that is set in the Lost Cause world called Making Hay. And then finally, I'm not quite co-writing, but I'm definitely collaborating with my colleague and friend Rebecca Giblin, the Australian copyright scholar, on a book about how a copyright that was oriented around enriching authors instead of shifting a few balance points from the entertainment industry to the tech industry or vice versa would be designed. So that's a lot in the air. And in addition, of course, we've got all of the normal EFF stuff going on and stuff with our family and so on. But I'm keeping busy. It's how I stay sane as the spaceship Earth plummets into the sun and we face our imminent incineration. And I hope that you have a way to cope with our impending incineration too, fellow traveler. Well, today I'm going to read to you part 6 of my 2006 novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, a book that Gene Wolfe called a glorious book, unlike any book you have ever read, which is, you know, a hell of a blurb. Without further ado then, part 6 of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. And once again, a reader's note here. One of the characters in this scene has a Scottish accent. My Scottish accent is easily the worst Scottish accent you have ever heard, and I will not be attempting a Scottish accent. My apologies to my Scottish readers, both for my non-attempt of the accent and how bad that attempt would be were I to essay it. She caught him at lunch. He was sitting in a corner of the schoolyard, eating from a paper sack of mushrooms and dried rabbit, and keeping an eye on Edward Frederick George as he played tag with the other kindergartners. She snuck up behind him and dropped a handful of gravel down the gap of his pants and into his underpants. He sprang to his feet, sending gravel rattling out of the cuffs of his jeans. "Hey," he said, and she popped something into his mouth. It was wet and warm from her hand, and it squirmed. He spat it out, and it landed on the schoolyard with a soft splat. It was an earthworm, thick with loamy soil. "You," he said, casting about for a curse of sufficient vehemence. "You." She hopped from foot to foot in front of him, clearly delighted with this reaction. He reached out for her and she danced back. He took off after her and they were chasing around the yard, around hopscotches and tag games and sandcastles and out to the marshy wood. She skidded through the puddles and he leapt over them. She ducked under a branch and he caught her by the hood of her windbreaker. Without hesitating, she flung her arms in the air and slithered out of the windbreaker, down to a yellow t-shirt that rode up her back, exposing her pale freckles and the knobs of her spine, the fingers of her ribs. She took off again and he balled the windbreaker up in his fist and took off after her. She stepped behind a bushy pine, and when he rounded the corner, she was waiting for him, her hands clawed, digging at his tummy, leaving him giggling. He pitched back onto the pine needles, and she followed, straddling his waist and tickling him until he coughed and choked and gasped for air. "Tell me," she said, "tell me your secrets." "Stop," Alan said. "Please, I'm gonna piss myself." "What's that to me?" she said, tickling more vigorously. He tried to buck her off, but she was too fast. He caught one wrist, but she pinned his other arm with her knee. He heaved, and she collapsed on top of him. Her face was inches from his, her breath moist on his face. They both panted, and he smelled her hair, which was over his face and neck. She leaned forward and closed her eyes expectantly. He tentatively brushed his lips across hers, and she moved closer, and they kissed. It was wet and a little gross, but not altogether unpleasant. She leaned back and opened her eyes and then grinned at him. "That's enough torture for one day," she said. "You're free to go." She tortured him at morning and afternoon recess for the next 2 weeks, and when he left the school on Friday afternoon after the last bell, she was waiting for him in the schoolyard. "Hello," she said, socking him in the arm. "Hi," he said. "Why don't you invite me over for supper this weekend?" she said. "Supper?" "Yes, I'm your girlfriend, yeah? So you should have me around to your place to meet your parents. Next weekend, you can come around to my place and meet my dad." "I can't," he said.
"You can't?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"It's a secret," he said.
"Ooh, a secret," she said. "What kind of secret?"
"A family secret. We don't have people over for dinner. That's just the way it is."
"A secret? They're all child molesters?"
He shook his head.
"Horribly deformed."
He shook his head.
"What then? Give us a hint."
"It's a secret." She grabbed his ear and twisted it, gently at first, then harder.
"A secret?" she said.
"Yes," he gasped.
"Yes, it's a secret. I can't tell you. You're hurting me."
"I should hope so," she said, "and it will go very hard for you indeed if you don't tell me what I want to know." He grabbed her wrist and dug his strong fingers into the thin tendons on its insides, twisting his fingers for maximal effect. Abruptly, she released his ear and clenched her wrist hard, sticking it between her thighs.
"Oh, that bloody hurt, you bastard. What did you do that for?"
"My secrets," Alan said. "Our secret." She held her wrist up and examined it.
"Heaven help you if you've left a bruise, Alvin," she said. "I'll kill you."
She turned her wrist from side to side. "All right," she said, "all right, kiss it better, and you can come to my place for supper on Saturday at 6 p.m. She shoved her arm into his face, and he kissed the soft skin on the inside of her wrist, putting a little tongue in it. She giggled and punched him in the arm. "Saturday, then," she called as she ran off. Edward Felix Gerald were too young to give him shit about his schoolyard romance, and Brian was too sensitive, but Dave had taken to lurking about the schoolyard, spying on the children, and he'd seen Marcy break off from a clench with Alan, take his hand, and plant it firmly on her tiny breast, an act that had shocked Danny to the core. "Hi, pervert," Danny said, as he stepped into the cool of the cave. Pervert was Davy's new nickname for him, and he had a finely honed way of delivering it so that it dripped with contempt. "Did you have sex with your girlfriend today, pervert?" Alan turned away from him and helped EFG take off his shoes and roll up the cuffs of his pants so that he could go down to the lake in the middle of their father and wade in the shallows, listening to their father's winds soughing in the great cavern. "Did you touch her boobies? Did she suck your pee-pee? Did you put your finger in her?" The litany would continue until Davy went to bed, and even then he wasn't safe. One night, Alan had woken up to see Darren standing over him, hands planted on his hips, face twisted into an elaborate sneer. "Did you put your penis inside of her?" he'd hissed, and then gone to bed. Albie went out again, climbing the rock face faster than Doug could keep up with him, so that by the time he'd found his perch high over the woodlands, where he could see the pines dance in the wind and the ant-sized cars zooming along the highway, Doug was far behind, likely sat atop their mother, sucking his thumb and sulking and thinking up new perversions to accuse Alan of. Saturday night arrived faster than Alan could have imagined. He spent Saturday morning in the woods, picking mushrooms and checking his snares, then headed down to town on Saturday afternoon to get a haircut and haunt the library. Converting his father's gold to cash was easier than getting a library card without an address. There was an old assayer whom the golems had described to him before his first trip to town. The man was cheap, but knew enough about the strangeness on the mountain not to cheat him too badly. The stern librarian, who glared at him while he walked the shelves, sometimes looking at the titles, sometimes the authors, and sometimes the Dewey Decimal numbers, had no such fear. The Deweys were fascinating. They traced the fashions in human knowledge and wisdom. It was easy enough to understand why the arbiters of the system subdivided motorized land vehicles, 69.2, into several categories. But here in the 69.22s, where the books on automobiles were, you could see the planner's deficiencies. Automobiles divided into dozens of major subcategories: taxis and limousines, buses, light trucks, cars, lorries, tractor trailers, campers, motorcycles, racing cars, and so on, and then ramified into a combinatorial explosion of sub-sub-sub-categories. There were Dewey numbers on some of the automotive book spines that had 20 digits or more after the decimal, an entire Dewey decimal system hidden between 629.2 and 629.3. To the librarian, this shelf reading looked like your garden variety screwing around, but what really made her nervous were Alan's excursions through the card catalog, which required constant tending to replace the cards that errant patrons made unauthorized reorderings of. The subject headings in the third bank of card drawers were the most interesting of all. They, too, branched and forked and rejoined themselves like the meanderings of an ant colony on the march. He'd go in sequence for a while, then start following cross-references when he found an interesting branch, keeping notes on scraps of paper on top of the file drawer. He spent quite some time in the mythology categories, looking up golems and goblins, looking up changelings and monsters, looking up seers and demigods, but none of the books he'd taken down off the shelves had contained anything that helped him understand his family better. His family was uncatalogued and unclassified in human knowledge. He rang the bell on Marcy's smart little brick house at bang on six, carrying some daisies he'd bought from the grocery store, following the etiquette laid down in several rather yucky romance novels he'd perused that afternoon. She answered in jeans and a t-shirt and punched him in the arm before he could give her the flowers. "Don't you look smart," she said. "Well, you're not fooling anyone, you know." She gave him a peck on the cheek and snatched away the daisies. "Come along then, we're eating soon." Marcy sat him down in the living room, which was furnished with neutral sofas and a neutral carpet and a neutral coffee table. The bookcases were bare. "It's horrible," she said, making a face. She was twittering a little, dancing from foot to foot. Alan was glad to know he wasn't the only one who was uncomfortable. "Isn't it? The company put us up here. We had a grand flat in Scotland." "It's nice," Alan said, "but you could use some books." She crossed her eyes. Books? Sure, I've got 10 boxes of them in the basement. You can come by and help me unpack them. 10 boxes? Alan said. You're making that up. 10 boxes of books? Things like books didn't last long under the mountain, in the damp with the ever-inquisitive, ever-destructive Davy exploring every inch of floor and cave and corridor in search of opportunities for pillage. I ain't neither, she said. At least 10. It was a grand flat, and they were all in alphabetical order, too. Can we go see? Alan said, getting up from the sofa. See boxes? Yes, Alan said, and look inside. We can unbox them after dinner, okay? That's more of an afternoon project, said a voice from the top of the stairs. That's my Dash, she said. Come down and introduce yourself to Alan, Dash, he said. You're not the voice of God, so you can bloody well turn up and show your face. No more sass, gal, or it will go very hard for you, said the voice. The accent was like Marcy's squared, thick as oatmeal, liqueur thick, nearly incomprehensible, but the voice was kind and smart and patient, too. You'll have a hard time giving me any licks from the top of the stairs, Da, and Alan looks like he's going to die if you don't at least come down and say hello. Alan blushed furiously. You can come down whenever you like, sir, he said. That's all right. That's mighty generous of you, young sir, said the voice. Aye, but before I come down, tell me, are your intentions towards my daughter honorable? His cheeks grew even hotter, and his ears felt like they were melting with embarrassment. Yes, sir, he said in a small voice. He's a dreadful pervert, Da, Marcy said. You should see the things he tries. You'd kill him, you would. She grinned foxish and punched him in the shoulder. He sank into the cushions, face suddenly drained of blood. What? Roared the voice, and there was a clatter of slippers on the neutral carpet of the stairs. Alan didn't want to look, but found that he couldn't help himself. His head inexorably turned toward the sound until a pair of thick legs hove into sight, whereupon Marcy leapt into his lap and threw her arms around his neck. Get off me, pervert, she said as she began to cover his face in darting, pecking kisses. He went rigid and tried to sink all the way into the sofa. All right, that's enough of that, her father said. Marcy stood and dusted herself off. Alan stared at his knees. She's horrible, isn't she? Said the voice, and a great, thick hand appeared in his field of vision. He shook it tentatively, noting the heavy class ring and the thin, plain wedding band. He looked up slowly. Marcy's father was short but powerfully built, like the wrestlers in the other kids' lunchboxes at school. He had a shock of curly black hair that was flecked with dandruff, and a thick bristling mustache that made him look very fierce, though his eyes were gentle and bookish behind thick glasses. He was wearing wool trousers and a cable-knit sweater that was unraveling at the elbows. "Pleased to meet you, Albert," he said. They shook hands gravely. I've been after to unpack those books since we moved here. You could come by tomorrow afternoon and help if you'd like. I think it's the only way I'll get herself to stir her lazy bottom and do some chores around here. Oh, damn, Marcy said. Who cooks around here? Who does the laundry? The takeaway pizza man does the majority of the cooking, daughter. And as for laundry, the last time I checked, there were 2 weeks' worth of laundry to do. Da, she said in a sweet voice. I love you, Da, she said, wrapping her arms around his trim waist. You see what I have to put up with, her father said, snatching her up and dangling her by the ankles. She flailed her arms around and made outraged choking noises while he swung her back and forth like a pendulum, releasing her at the top of one arc so that she flopped onto the sofa in a tangle of thin limbs. It's a madhouse around here, her father continued, as Marcy righted herself, knocking Alan in the temple with a tennis shoe. But what can you do? Once she's a little bigger, I can put her to work in the mines, and then I'll have a little peace around here. He sat down on an overstuffed armchair with a fussy antimacassar. He's got a life insurance policy, Marcy said conspiratorially. I'm just waiting for him to kick the bucket, and then I'm going to retire. Oh, aye, her father said, retire. Your life is an awful one, is it? Junior high is a terrible hardship, I know. Alan found himself grinning. What's so funny? Marcy said, punching him in the shoulder. You two are, he said, grabbing her arm and then digging his fingers into her tummy, doubling her over with tickles. All right, that's this week then. I hope you can come and see my keynote this week, and otherwise you might be able to catch it later on video. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, WRYNECK Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.